piping porridge. Here's to the biscuit tot. Here's to the java flowing like lava out of the coffee pot. Here's to the eggs and bacon. Here's to the waffles unique. And here's three rousing cheers for the best meal of the week. For it's Sunday morning, breakfast time, the time all men adore.
Hi, I'm John Jackson.
And I'm Greg Patent.
And we're the Food Guys. It seems like two or three times in the past, we have mentioned, almost in passing, the thrifty gene hypothesis. You recall that.
We should help our listeners recall it.
See, now there was this guy, James V. Neal, in 1962. He was a geneticist. He actually started the first department of genetics at the University of Michigan. He was concerned about the epidemic of diabetes that he was seeing in the community, and he was trying to account for it. And he came up with a very interesting little hypothesis, which got to be dubbed the thrifty gene hypothesis. What it said was that prior to modern times, various cultures had not experienced a consistent amount of food. Previously, they'd been on a feast and famine regimen.
Once we developed agriculture and we had communities that were centered around an agricultural core, it was basically foraging and hunting and gathering. You could be feasting if you were very successful in your hunting and your gathering, and then you could also be starving almost before there was another hunt or another period where you were able to gather food.
Yeah.
And so this got him to thinking about a genetic makeup that could account for food storage, basically, helping us store fat at a time when we really needed to store fat.
He believed at that time, this is early days in genetics, 1962, he knew, for instance, that there was a genetic basis for diabetes. That's certainly been proven out. But he tended to believe that it was a single gene.
Right, and that turns out not to be the case.
And it's a complex of genes, quite clearly. They've already identified 36 different genes that would have some impact, and those only account for about 10% of what actually they think the real genetic input should have been. It's a complex genetic structure behind it. So that was one problem with his hypothesis, that somehow a gene had evolved that tended to set aside, as it were, some of the food you were eating, even though you could easily have metabolized it. It shifted it off to fat cells.
Right, it made a deposit. It's not just one gene.
Then the idea was that the hard times come, and, oh, you've got this little bank here of fat, which you can consume. Your body will consume it. It will at least keep you alive. You won't get much pleasure out of it.
No.
What the heck? The thrifty gene. Now we come to a period in which our food supply is pretty constant. We don't have this feast and famine thing. This should be particularly noticed in people who came late to this situation. Let's say the Yanomami people of the Brazilian forest, whom, in fact, Neal had studied because he was also an anthropologist of sorts. He had studied them, and somehow he could never get this quite to work because he couldn't detect the other telltale signs of diabetic precursors in the makeup of these people. They were suffering from eating way too much and gaining too much weight. Obesity was a big problem for them, and they were developing diabetes. But then when he looked at the young warriors, he couldn't find any evidence that they were already suffering from glucose intolerance or anything like that, which would be a giveaway sign. And there were other features that ultimately led him, by 1998, late in his career and his life, he died a couple of years later, to say, well, you know, we just haven't proven it. It seems like a good idea. As a hypothesis, it was welcomed in many circles, don't you think?
Yes, it was. He responded very well to the criticisms.
Yes, he did.
Because he was very open-minded.
Yep.
And he knew there were people conducting all kinds of research along the lines that he had proposed and not coming up with the kinds of findings that he was expecting. Yeah. And he was really quite open about it.
Yeah, and he adjusted his hypothesis on various levels. Whenever new evidence would come to light, he would say, ah, yes, I see, I'm going to have to account for that. And he would work on it, and he would come to grips with it. Things like the fact that it's clearly more than one gene, for instance.
It's a very interesting idea of conservation, basically. How do we conserve at a time when there's nothing around?
Yeah, the interesting thing to me was when I have recently been doing a lot of study on Native Americans in their pre-industrial period before the real impact of the European invasion, they actually consumed quite a bit of sugar, curiously enough. They made maple sugar. A small clan would make 1,600 pounds of it. That's an amazing thing. They were consuming quite a bit of sugar at specific times.
At specific times, and that's the key. Not all the time.
And that was before, as the Native Americans say, the great shift indoors. We all live indoors now.
Right.
That has had a huge impact.
Yes. We use our bodies less.
Yes, we do. Now, with that information, we'll come back next week for
The Food Guys. La 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 la